If you look at aviation, you know, the early days weren't so safe, but every accident got a root cause review. And the industry at least used to be really good at learning from these things. Every time I read something that's like, well, we shouldn't have self-driving cars until we can prove they're perfectly safe, I'm like, no, you're actually killing the on-ramp. You're killing the on-ramp to safety. And, you know, we have to allow things to come to market so long as they're better. And then we can make them perfect over time.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Vanta. Compliance and security shouldn't be a deal breaker for startups to win new business. Vanta makes it easy for companies to get a SOC 2 report fast. Twist listeners can get $1,000 off for a limited time at vanta.com/twist. Squarespace. Turn your idea into a new website. Go to squarespace.com/twist for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use offer code TWIST to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. And OpenPhone. Create business phone numbers for you and your team that work through an app on your smartphone or desktop. TWIST listeners can get an extra 20% off any plan for your first 6 months at openphone.com/twist.
All right, everybody, welcome back to This Week in Startups. Very excited to have our guest on again today for the second time. His name is Blake Scholl. He is the CEO and founder of Boom Supersonic, and they are making supersonic planes. He was last on This Week in Startups back on episode 638. It's been a minute. And as you know, we in this amazing technological miracle of an existence have seen so much change in the past 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. One thing that's gone in the wrong direction is the speed of flight. Things have gotten slower. And the dream of supersonic flight, which I, as a kid, was enamored with because we had something called the Concorde that left out of JFK, not too far from my home in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. And you could get to London in a very short period of time. Welcome back to the program, Blake. When was the last Concorde flight? Was that in the 90s or late 80s?
It was the early 2000s, actually 2003. It shut down. I was 22 years old, never got to fly on it.
Yeah, I never got to fly on it as well. But I knew people who did, and I would regularly in New York meet people. So they were flying them as late as 2003. And there were one or two accidents, I think, tragically. And it also maybe was too expensive. Why did the Concorde program fail? Why did nobody ever replicate it?
Well, there are many layers to that onion. There was one accident, which actually for a 1960s airplane design, one accident in 30 years of flying is actually a good safety record. So that I don't think that was the real story. Go one level deeper, it was economics. This was an airplane with 100 not very comfortable seats. They cost $20,000 a ticket. And you just can't fill 100 seats at $20,000 a pop, especially not with 80s, 90s kind of travel demand. And if you go a layer deeper than that, it's actually a story about product market fit, because that doesn't make any sense as a product. That price point, that experience doesn't go to a scalable market. If you go a layer deeper than that, it's really about the birth and death of entrepreneurship in an industry, where for the first 50 years of aviation, from the Wright brothers forward, founders were in charge of their companies. We had a very entrepreneurially driven model of innovation in aerospace. And what happened in the 60s is that all the founders retired from the industry. And we shifted from commercially driven product development to national prestige driven. So Concorde was not a startup. It wasn't even an established company. It was two governments. The French government, the British government got together. They basically handcuffed themselves together and said, we're going to build a supersonic jet to beat the Russians. And we're not going to think too hard about the economics. And of course, the phrase product market fit had not been invented yet. And so they went off and did something that was technically marvelous, but commercially made no sense.
And that's really crazy to think of, that it was a government-sponsored program. Well, beating the Russians was one dynamic in it, but was there some economic or pride to doing this?
Well, so it was established via treaty in 1962. And so this was the height of the Cold War. And the thing that I think it helps to kind of hold in context is we had the First World, It was the West. And we had the second world that was the communist world. And the first and second worlds were fighting over the third world. And the mindset that we were in geopolitically was that what we had to do was impress the third world. And that would like impact which countries would align with Soviet Russia and which would align with the West. And so this is very much the same motivation for why we did Apollo. You know, we went to the moon, not because it made any sense to go to the moon. At least not in the way we did it. But we wanted to show that American rocket technology was better than Russian rocket technology.
Yeah. And so, yeah. And for people who don't know, when you fly a supersonic plane, it creates a boom, the name of your startup, boom. I guess as a hat tip to that. And this is why it only flew from the east coast of New York to those European cities. So there was also this geography that played a bit of a role, yes?
Sort of. I mean, I think it's half true and it's half mythology. Anytime a supersonic plane flies supersonic, it creates a sound called a sonic boom, which if you do it really close to the ground, it can be pretty obnoxious. But if you do it up at altitude, it's more like this sound of thunder. And you can fly a supersonic airplane without making a sonic boom just by flying it a little bit slower. So the way we're doing our Overture airliner is we're about 20% faster over land, right under the sound barrier. So there's no question of like, is the sonic boom too loud or not? And there's still a speed up relative to a Boeing or Airbus. Then we got out over open ocean where no one's there to hear the boom, push the throttles forward, and we go fully two times faster. So it makes sense to focus on the routes that are more transoceanic because that's where you get the bigger speed ups. But then, you know, people remember Concorde, New York to London, because it was the only one that had anywhere close to the economic legs to make it work. But, you know, we're going to be able to do Miami, Madrid, and Seattle to Tokyo, and LA to Sydney. And, you know, there are over 600 routes around the planet where this is going to have a big speed up and make economic sense as well.
You know, it's very weird. Everybody knows the typical routes, like I think it was Washington, D.C. and New York to Paris and London, obviously. It makes total sense. They also went to Barbados, which was bizarre, like Paris to Barbados, 4 hours, which is incredible because that would normally be 8 or 9 hours to the Caribbean. Any indication of why they did that? Or did you even know that?
Yeah, no, I knew that. They did that. They did Bahrain. British Airways had one that would take to Singapore, I think with a stop in Bahrain. It was kind of a neat concept. The airplane, if you looked at it from one side, was British Airways livery. If you looked at it from the other side, it was Singapore Airlines. So it was literally one logo on one side, the other logo on the other side. But they tried it in a bunch of places, but just fundamentally, you know, everybody wants faster flight so long as it's affordable and it's safe. The problem was that it wasn't affordable and it wasn't comfortable. And then that one accident didn't happen until it was about time to shut it down anyway. But it left with this kind of hangover, like, is there a safety question?
Listen, a strong sales team can make all the difference for a B2B startup. But if you're going to hire sharks, you need to let them hunt. And you can't slow them down with compliance hurdles like SOC 2. What is SOC 2? Well, any company that stores customer data in the cloud needs to be SOC 2 compliant. If you don't have your SOC 2 tight, your sales team can't close major deals. It's that simple. But thankfully, Vanta makes it really easy to get and renew your SOC 2 compliance. On average, Vanta customers are compliant in just 2 to 4 weeks. Without Vanta, it takes 3 to 5 months. Vanta can save you hundreds of hours of work and up to 85% on compliance costs. And Vanta does more than just SOC 2. They also automate up to 90% compliance for GDPR, HIPAA, and more. So here's your call to action. Stop slowing your sales team down and use Vanta. Get $1,000 off at vanta.com/twist. That's vanta.com/twist for $1,000 off your SOC 2. So you've been at this for close to a decade now, correct?
Yeah, I think we'll turn 10 on paper in a few weeks.
In a few weeks, I had that idea. So it was a good idea to have you on here to talk about this 10-year journey. Obviously, a lot of this was just getting people to believe that it was even possible. You were able to raise some money for this. And recently, you had a test flight, I understand, of one of the prototypes. So take us through where you're at today. The question everybody wants to know is, when can I get one of these? Are they going to be for billionaires? Are they going to be, you know, as part of the United fleet or JetBlue? And how much is it going to cost? So take us through where you're at today and how many more years it will be before we're in one of these.
Well, I'll just start with the bottom line up front. The ultimate goal is to enable virtually anybody to be able to fly supersonic. And the first airplane called the Overture is basically all premium class. And so if you can fly business class today, you're going to be able to fly twice as fast on Overture. And so that's about a quarter of what it costs on Concorde. So I think Concorde about a $20,000 ticket in order for it to make any money, and just it didn't work really. No legs there.
Per leg or it's a 40 round trip? Round trip. Yeah, so okay. So you think you can do it for five?
I do five. It would be very profitable at five. You know, so just take one example, New York, London, with 80% of the seats full, which is a little bit less than what airlines usually get today. The break-even fare will actually be $3,500 round trip. And so any dollar above $3,500, the airlines are making money. And I think what we'll find is, especially in the early years, when there aren't yet enough of these flying, the market clearing fares are going to be pretty high. Stratospheric, I guess, would be the phrase to use. And it's going to be a flying mint for the airlines. But, you know, with Overture 1, as supply catches up with demand, the cost is going to come down. You know, I think $5,000 is probably a good number to kind of hold in mind for what a typical ticket could be, which, of course, is not that different from what people pay in business class today.
And actually, business class in the summer to Europe is more like $10,000 to $15,000, pretty standard. So
five years for first passenger flight. And to give you a sense of where we're at. So we had our first test flight in March. We had our second test flight 2 weeks ago. Oh. And that's on what we call the XB1, which is, you know, one third the size of Overture. So I think you have a picture of that if we want to show it.
Yeah, let's show the test flight. So this is really the manifestation of how many years in the laboratory? How many years in the laboratory is this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we spent a lot of time kind of just figuring the company out. Like on day one, it was really just me. Yep. And we didn't start building the airplane for quite a while after that. We had to get the resources together. It actually turned out it was critical to get orders before we started building in order to be able to obtain financing.
That makes sense.
Yep. The last 2-3 years have just been enormous acceleration. So XB1, so that's what you're looking at there. It's the scale of a fighter jet, but this has got all the airliner technology on it. It's got a carbon fiber composite fuselage. It's got an augmented reality vision system for landing. It's got software optimized aerodynamics. And the most shocking thing is that we didn't actually invent anything to build that airplane. All we did is bring technologies together that were technologies that have been invented over the last 50 years since Concorde was designed that allow us to get past a tipping point on efficiency so that we can get to product market fit. And that airplane's about 66 feet long. It's got about a 20-foot wingspan, and Overture is about three times bigger. It's about 200 feet long, even proportionally bigger wingspan, about 100-foot wingspan. And on board, it's all premium class. So I think business class, maybe some first class, 64 seats. And we actually just opened the factory where we're going to build this in North Carolina. And so we're getting going. And the goal's been ready for you and I to fly on it in 5 years.
Now that has a United logo on it. Is that customer zero, United?
So we actually, Japan Airlines was first to pre-order.
Okay.
Then United was the first to make an order with a non-refundable deposit, which that was a real big deal. Okay. And then American Airlines also made an order with a deposit. So we've got about 130 announced orders and pre-orders between United, America, and Japan Airlines. And to put that in context, basically what that means is the first 5 years of production are booked. There was a line out the door for airlines wanting supersonic jets. You know, it's just our job to go deliver them.
Hmm. And these are going to cost $200 million, something in that range?
Yeah, it's $200 million a copy. And that's one of the interesting things with the business is just like surprising things. One, we don't need to deal with a sonic boom in order to have a business model here. Number two, we don't actually have to invent anything fundamentally new. It's just engineering with technology that already exists. And then number three, you know, the, all we have to do is take this, the small scale design and scale it up.
So if we were to compare this in terms of price, I mean, the highest end of the private jet market tops out with the like global 700 or something, $70-75 million. It's kind of like as good as it gets in private in terms of speed and height and that stuff. And then you start looking at like the Boeing lineup, the 737s, those go for $150-ish, $125. Am I correct?
That market has very obscure pricing. The real price is usually about half of the advertised price. And so, So a 737 goes for approximately half of list price. Same thing true with all these aircraft. And the reason is that it's a commodity market. For every product in Boeing's catalog, there's an Airbus product, which is a near identical clone. So the 737 and the A320, you know, as an airplane nerd, I know which one I'm on. I can tell even what engine it is. But for 99% of passengers, they have no idea. And unless they're worried about the airplane coming apart, they don't even care. And then from an airline perspective, you know, so the A320 kind of equals a 737, a 787 kind of equals an A350, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like the, you know, the
so you're saying those $120 million planes actually get sold for 60 or 70?
Yep.
It's a stupid question. Why don't private buyers buy some of those? Is it the maintenance, or it's just obscenely large and you can't land them at most airports and the maintenance?
It's the size and the airport compatibility. You know, like part of the idea of flying private is that you're able to get in closer to your final destination. And so there are all these, you know, a lot of people who fly commercial don't realize this, the country is covered in small airports. And a small airplane can get in and out of a small airport. And then that saves the hassle of a big commercial terminal. And it probably gets you closer to your destination. And so you can get a whole 737 for your own use. And that Boeing sells, that's called a BBJ, Boeing Business Jet.
Yes. I've been on a couple of those. Yeah. I have a couple of friends who have those. They're ridiculous.
They don't suck. Let's just call it that. But
it's crazy. The one I was on was set up with, I would say, 6 or 7. Like individual cabins, maybe 8 even. It was crazy. And like each one had multiple seating areas. So it was
a lot of
airplane. And those range, you said yours is how many feet long?
About 200 feet long, tip to tail.
Got it. It's longer than the 320 or something like that, right?
Yeah, just by a little bit. It's probably about 20-30 feet longer than the longest A320 series airplane. So it's almost exactly the same length as a 777, to put that in context. But it's much skinnier. And so actually you can kind of see it behind me. So I'm standing in our passenger experience lab, and you know, one of the things we can talk about is that whole aspect of it. But what you're looking at is kind of a full-scale mock-up, tip to tail of the passenger cabin. Of course, there's cockpit in front of it, and there's baggage and, you know, mechanical equipment behind it, and that all adds up to the 200 feet. So the passenger cabin is less than 200 feet, and it's also a bit skinnier.
And this will be closer to, you know, what's the configuration? One seat on each side, like that was how the Concorde was, one on each side, or was it two on each side?
Concorde was two and two the whole way through. You know, we've talked about having one and one. So actually, one of the things that makes Overture more efficient than Concorde is we've shaped the fuselage differently. So it's actually, if we could pull that United render back up, you could see in the front of the airplane, it's actually a bit fatter. And yes. As you go back, it gets skinnier. And you'll notice that the windows actually stop. The last passenger row is actually ahead of the engines. That's an important safety feature. But the airplane's bigger in the front and it's skinnier in the back. In the back, it's a 1+1, and in the front we've talked about it could be a 2+2, and
could have seating,
mm-hmm.
but as you go back it narrows. So it nobody narrows, is yeah. nobody doesn't have a window, and nobody's above the engine, or
that's right. So in the back is really nice actually. So it's one seat on each side of the aisle, so you don't have to choose window seat or aisle seat, and everybody gets both.
Back, you kind of mean the middle of the plane, right? Like
The middle of the airplane, but the back of the passenger cabin. So, you know, if you look at the last, you know, like 7 windows there.
Yes.
Those are the last 7 rows of seats.
Got it. So these will all be the business class seats. And so it will feel like a large private jet or a small commercial jet. I'm not sure what the jet is. I'm trying to think of the ones that have two and two.
Right. So the by the way, we haven't revealed the final design. And okay. I think when people we've said it's 2+2. It may or may not actually be 2+2.
Sure.
There's something I can't talk about yet.
That
I hope you can hear it in my voice. I'm really excited about it.
Are you going to stack people on top of each other? I saw like some crazy Japanese airline had done that.
No.
But you know, if you have cabins or you do what JetBlue Mint does, where they do the 2-1-2, there are some really interesting things you can do in terms of maximizing space. So I'm sure you've got.
So one of our philosophies is that you really want designers that think like engineers and engineers that think like designers. And so we've put a lot of energy into building that into the product development culture. And we've got something really magical that we'll show it probably next year. And when people see it, they'll be like, there's no way you got that in a small, skinny airplane. It just couldn't be. Because the first time I saw it, that was my reaction. I thought there's just no way.
So that's what's in that customer experience behind you is what you're
that's
working
right.
on. Got it. Okay.
That's right. Yeah.
We'll have you back next year to debut that here on This Week in Startups. I don't care if you're building enterprise SaaS, a verticalized AI startup, or the next great consumer app. No matter what you are cooking up, you have to have a brilliant website. It's the first thing that people see or read from your startup, and it has to be beautiful. You got to make a great first impression. People do judge a book by its cover. It's that simple. That's why we have that expression. But since you're building a company, you're strapped for time. You know that. And wouldn't it be nice to have some world-class help? How about a beautiful website built to your specifications quickly and easily? It's 2024. If you don't already know HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, that ship has sailed. Get on Squarespace and check out their Blueprint AI product. You answer 5 questions, and Squarespace's new AI tool is going to build you a gorgeous website. It's so simple. It's so slick. It's just brilliant. It's the future. Even better, you don't need to worry about what's under the hood. Analytics, SEO, payments, memberships, e-commerce. You can do it all. It's all included too. So here's your call to action. Check out squarespace.com/twist for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/twist to get 10% off your first website or domain purchase. That's squarespace.com/twist. Tell me a little bit about what you've learned during this journey about how the markets have changed for startups. You know, we're here on This Week in Startups, and the idea of a startup company doing something other than an app or SaaS software or a marketplace or, you know, anything in that software realm has changed radically since, you know, I think since Uber, Airbnb, and SpaceX and Tesla. I think when you saw those four cohort, they really operated in the real world in a way that I remember watching them. They were received very poorly by venture capitalists at first, and then very significantly. You know, that's changed dramatically. Now you got Parker doing Anduril. You've got all kinds of space products. You know, people are not afraid to do large scale, big tech products, whether it's bombs or drones or, in your case, planes. So tell me about, you know, you straddled that market. You've been around for 10 years. So SpaceX existed, Uber existed, but they were kind of upstarts. And then you struggled a bit to get people to believe in this. So take us through that journey.
Yeah. Well, I think if we pull the camera back even like one click further from that, it's the period where we weren't doing hardware startups. It's really the anomaly. So if you look backwards to the early 1900s, from the Wright brothers forward, so the Wrights first flew in 1903. Of course, they were bicycle entrepreneurs. That was a startup. And by the way, one with, you know, no credibility that they should have been able to go invent the airplane, but yet they did it. And then from the Wright brothers through about 1921 was sort of a golden age of aviation. And there's a lot of companies that got created then, the ones that we all know the names of now. You know, not just Wright, but also Douglas and Lockheed and Boeing all got created. But the last one was 1921. And by the way, if you look at automotive industry, you see the same pattern. There was a golden age of automotive, and then there was this long period of no entrepreneurship. And in aviation, the founders all retired in the 1960s. In fact, the introduction of the last mainstream speed up in flight, when we went from props to jets, coincides with the retirement of founders. So that the first jetliner was the de Havilland Comet. The first successful one came from Boeing, but the actual first one that really kicked off the jet age with the de Havilland Comet, created by de Havilland while he was still running the company. And then what kind of happened is the people who had worked with the founders took over. And then we ended up in this kind of, there was innovation happening, but much more from an optimization kind of perspective. You know, so the 707, which is Boeing's first jetliner, if you put it right next to the 787, which is their latest, unless you're an airplane nerd, it's hard to tell the difference. It's a long, skinny tube with some wings and the engines hanging under the wings. Looks kind of the same. And by the way, it flies basically the same speed. And then the even worse thing happened, which was that the people who had respected it and learned from the founders left. And then the bean counters took over. And then that really wrecked wrecked commercial aviation. I wish that were just purely metaphorical, but at Boeing, it's literal.
So let's pause there for a second. I think it's like a good thing to double click on since we went down this sort of history lesson, which is super fascinating, because these companies, people forget how old Boeing is as a company. These were an Airbus. These were created in the 20s and 30s, correct?
Before then. The last 16. One was Douglas in 1921, Boeing was 1910s.
Oh, wow. Incredible. So these things are incredibly old, and it's really interesting to see who winds up running them. They are being run now, you said bean counters, but they're being run to lower the cost of aviation. And that reminds me in some ways of the Uber story, because the goal was, how do you get this in the hands of more people? It reminds me of the Android story or the PC story, you know, Dell computers, et cetera. How do we have these devices become incredibly affordable, or services, you know, Uber Black, SUV X, then even Pool, and then eventually self-driving might be cheaper. We'll see. It might be more expensive. And then you have this counter trend, which is luxury comes back, or performance, or elite services. And I guess the comment about luxury is like luxury begins. I think Trump said the famous quote is luxury begins where necessity ends. So that's different, luxury, because that would be more like iPhones versus Android phones. But really, they just tried to make each mile and the maintenance of these planes cheaper and cheaper, to the point at which Boeing was so, the bean counters and accountants there tried to put through that goddamn MCAT system in order to not have to train people. So take me through the state of like, how deranged these people are behaving.
I think there are two things that we're conflating here that are really important to tease apart, because there is a totally valid journey of bringing the cost to travel down, whether we're talking a car you can summon from your phone or an airplane that'll take you to the other side of the planet. It makes sense to bring the cost of that down, because what that means is more people can go more places more often. And that will absolutely be part of our journey at Boom. We're starting with 75% less expensive than Concorde, still business class, still not for everybody, but I want to get to the point where it's never a cattle car experience, but it's the where the costs come down enough that people will travel around the planet just the same way they would call on Uber today. Imagine that future where flights are faster and the cost is a point where you don't think about it too hard. And therefore, you can, the way you'd impromptu get around your city, you'd impromptu go around the planet. Like, that's a very, very exciting future. And so that's one trend. And Boeing for a while was part of that trend of bringing the cost down. And I think that's all valid and appropriate as part of making, part of reaching a larger and larger market, which is entrepreneurs we should do. And then there's the other piece of it, which I think is pathological, which is a very short-term focus on financial results. And the best metaphor I have for this is, let me give you a little Boeing company history that'll contextualize it. So through about the 1990s, Boeing was really good at developing new airplanes. So they did it pretty quickly, did it pretty efficiently, and you could trust the airplane would come out would be safe. But they would invest a lot of money. They'd invest a few billion to develop an airplane, and then they'd ship it, and then they'd sell a lot and make their money back. And that continued through about 2004, when I think the last good CEO at Boeing left. And then they had a new guy come in who said the most insane thing. He said, "We're not going to do any more moonshots." And of course, it's ironic because this is the company that used to be literally in the moonshot business.
Like, literally, said, it wasn't a metaphor.
Literally,
we're
right?
Going to the moon.
I can't believe people say these things. But the So then they said, all we're going to do is tweak the products we already got. And we're going to, and the motivation for this was optimization of basically like next quarter financial results. And so a lot of Jack Welch acolytes kind of took over at Boeing. If you trace the histories of the individuals involved, they trace back to the Jack Welch acolytes. And Jack's thing was, you know, he always wanted to beat the street by a nickel every quarter. And you can do that for a little while. But it's like flying an airplane while only looking straight down. And so it'll be good for a little while, but pretty soon you're not going to be happy where you're at. And that's, you know, so Boeing tried to tweak the 737, and they you know, did a bunch of unnatural things. The MCAS, which is that's the system that was responsible for those crashes. That's one example, but you're doing it now with the 777. It's a big disaster. They have not. We should pause on this because I think, you know, the people who are listening today are, we're all like builders, entrepreneurs, and like, it's so normal that we make new things. Boeing has not launched an all new product for 20 years.
Right. They're just trying to make the existing ones more price competitive in a really rabid market where, as you said, the list price and the actual price varies by double or 50%.
That's right.
You have a situation where it's too competitive and it's just a race to the bottom and all margin has been taken out?
Yeah, well, it's a duopoly. And so between Boeing and Airbus, and so nobody moves unless the other one moves. And so the margins get compressed. And when in the world of margin compression, because there's lack of product differentiation, then it really creates this incentive. When we build a product, we want to keep it in production for like decades and we want to not reinvest because without the margin, it's harder to justify the payback. But it's this death spiral where like all the innovation drops out. If you drop the innovation out, it kind of kicks off the rest of this death spiral. It's okay, now there's no differentiation. The lack of differentiation drives lack of margin. Lack of margin drives lack of desire to invest in innovation. It just goes around in a bad way.
This is something you and I know natively, but might not be obvious from the outside, which is it's not compelling to work in a company like that for top performers. Like if you go to Facebook, you know, the people working on trying to make the incremental click on a Google ad or a Facebook ad, you know, if they were that good, they would be working at Boom or Anduril or SpaceX or XAI or ChatGPT, which is what happens. Really supremely talented people are drawn to the project, all things being equal, which is why some companies will give fantastical amounts of RSUs and stock-based comp because they know, gosh, this person could work at Boom or XAI or wherever, or they could work on the ad network. I mean, that sounds like death to us, right? Like,
yeah. Oh, I mean, I very ironically, earlier in my career, I worked in building automated advertising to the Amazon. But back when that was new and exciting, and it's not now. And so that center of gravity of innovation swings around, and within an industry, it swings between companies. But I think it also swings between industries. And you know, the if you look at people who were the big innovators, I think it's interesting to look back at what was going on when they were kids. And what inspired them. And in the late 1960s, you know, we lost our way as far as how to develop new products. We did Concorde and Apollo. Actually, both were 1969. And both are regarded as big technical breakthroughs. I think both were actually disasters. I think, you know, can't go back to the moon, can't fly supersonic. Like, it like literally killed progress. But what it did still do was inspire people to go into aerospace. And then we got into this moment where like nothing in aerospace was even exciting. And so, you know, people of my generation, I've loved airplanes since I was a kid. It never occurred to me to go have a career in it. I spent my first 15 years in tech because that's where new stuff was getting built.
Yeah. I mean, the internet, you know, was so inspiring, and dial up even before that in the 80s into the 90s, the idea that you could connect with anybody on the planet was like kind of mind-blowing. Like, it was kind of trippy, and it did capture everybody's imagination for a very long period of time. And then you get to a certain point where we are today, and you're like, yeah, everybody's online and it's a mess, and there's great things and there's, you know, misinformation and hate and rage and doom scrolling. So you know, you kind of see the full cycle, and then it's nice that people are kind of coming back to looking at projects and saying, well, what does this do for humanity and how exciting and thrilling is it? It's not very exciting or thrilling in many cases. And if you're doing things for just the money, which is what, in a way, Boeing was doing, when you're doing something for just money, at some point you get the money, and then all of a sudden you lose motivation, you know?
Yeah.
And you have to then say, well, am I actually into this? I see this in venture all the time. You have somebody like Paul Graham or myself or, you know, some other folks who are really into startups because we're passionate about entrepreneurship, whatever. And you make some money. And then I watched all my contemporaries who made money retire. They were like, yeah, I hit Uber, I hit Airbnb, I hit AngelList, I hit this, I hit that. And they're like, I'm going to go meditate. I'm going to go do things that are more important to me. So then you realize like, okay, they were into it to an extent, but they were mercenary in another way, which is when the money came in, they stopped being investors. And then you have people like Vinod or like Michael Moritz and Doug Leone who are supposed to be retired, but I go to Sequoia and I see them running around doing stuff. So
yeah.
Or Bill Gurley's supposed to be retired and all he's doing is talking to me about startups and, you know, he's doing all kinds of, he's still on boards and stuff like that. So I do find that super interesting. Like,
Yeah. Well, it is interesting because by the way, Paul Graham and Mike Moritz are both significant investors in Boom and both actually pretty involved.
If you use multiple devices and apps to run your business, you need OpenPhone. OpenPhone simplifies your communications with one simple app. And OpenPhone has rethought what a modern business phone can be. What's magical about OpenPhone is that it works through a simple, elegant app right on your existing phone, or you can even use it on your desktop. I know because we use it here at Launch and our sales team loves it. And you know what? Those phone numbers, those discussions, all those text messages, we need those to be on Launch phone numbers. We don't want those on people's personal phones where if they leave the company, it's distracting, it's annoying to your sales team as but one example. And we love having a shared number for customer support as well. We do a little round robin where different people can pick up the one phone number. So customers have one number, but we can have that phone call go to multiple people on the team. So we, you know, can just have somebody pick up the phone quicker. It's that simple. Answering the phone quickly is a best practice and it makes people love your product or service. OpenPhone is already super affordable at just $13 a month. My Lord, that's affordable. But Twitch listeners can get an extra 20% off for any plan. The first 6 months, that's incredibly generous. Just head over to openphone.com/twist. And what if you have an existing number with another service that you hate? Well, OpenPhone will port them over at no extra cost. Easy peasy lemon squeezy. So head over to openphone.com/twist and get a free trial and get 20% off.
What's it like to work with Michael Moritz? Because, you know, we have right now a lot of the investment class, whether it's Vinod or Michael Moritz or Marc Andreessen and Ben Horowitz fighting over Trump versus not Trump and never Trump's. Put all that politics aside, what is the nature of Michael Moritz as a partner?
I'm really grateful to have him involved. And he's incredibly wise. And he's I've always experienced him as, and Paul Graham is the same way. They show up more when things are hard than when things are easy. And you know, both of them, you know, there are other folks that are on this list for me as well, when it's going well, we don't hear from them. When there's some hard problem to solve, you know, I get on the phone with them and we work on it. And, you know, and one of the things I love about both of them, is they tell me what I need to hear, even when it's not pleasant to hear.
Candidness, right. It's a mm-hmm. hallmark. I think actually what you're experiencing, is this your first startup, by the way? I never asked you.
No, it's like, I don't know. It's my first significant one. My first
venture back?
My first
venture back.
No. So
you had a venture back before that?
Kind of, anyway. Like a big baby startup. Like in high school, I started an ISP in my parents' basement. But that never was. Nice. I tried to raise an angel round for my parents. I never succeeded in that. But we got to be ramen profitable. And then I sold it when I went to college. And then my first, what you really think of as a startup was in 2010, which was an iPhone e-commerce company. Which we sold to Groupon. So that was the first thing that was what you really think of as a startup.
So it's good. You got a single or double out of it.
It is, but it also was incredibly motivating for me because what we made, and I feel a little embarrassed to say this, made a barcode scanning game. If you make a list of like the most important thing in the world down to like the least important, barcode scanning games, that's like a new low.
What was the output of barcode scanning? Understanding all the prices and SKUs and where they existed in the world?
Yeah, like that's where we wanted to go with it. The idea was it would have a Foursquare-like game dynamic that would cause people to put in content, and then you could go scan a barcode and price compare, and that was sort of the notion of it.
Until you got kicked out of Walmart for doing it.
Yeah, and mostly I would get up in the morning and it was really hard because there's no such thing as an easy startup. They're all hard. And yeah. I would get up in the morning and I would think, why am I doing this?
Yes.
And so when we had a chance to sell it to Groupon, I was so excited to tap out because it just wasn't worth the pain.
The juice wasn't worth the squeeze, as we say.
The juice was not worth the squeeze.
What you're experiencing, by the way, with Michael Moritz in that instance or Paul Graham, is not that they show up when, this is I suspect, it's not that they show up when there's hard problems. It's that when there's hard problems, you go to them and they find out about the hard problems. And when things are going well, they know enough to let you cook. And this was a big lesson for me. And I got to work with Michael Moritz and Ruloff, and I got to meet Paul Graham in the very, very first couple of classes. And I think in the earlier part of investors' careers, they want to be involved in everything. And it's exciting to be part of the winning stuff. And then what you realize is, hey, when you get product market fit, you have market pull, and you hit that magical moment where United is putting in orders, and then, they'll put a deposit down. They'll check the box. And initial the box that says non-refundable. When you start getting those things done, you don't want to mess with the magic. Now it's like the band is in the studio and the tracks are laying down. Now, if the band is fighting and somebody's not showing up and, there's a fist fight over the console and people can't get the lyrics. Yeah, that's when the producer and the manager got to get in there and say, hey, I noticed we haven't laid a track. Should we maybe do a cover song here and get back into the groove? And I think that was one of the major lessons for me as an investor, is knowing when you can be of service and you can truly be helpful, and knowing when you're just noise. And I remember with Uber in those early days, there was a couple of investors who, when it was taking off, were super, I don't want to say taking credit for it, but doing a lot of press hits about it, et cetera. And then when you go back to that time period and you see me doing press hits, which sometimes you get either asked to do or you volunteer to do them, I jumped in when Travis was getting destroyed, when there was some controversy over variable pricing and surge pricing. I thought, you know what? Use me when nobody else will say yes to go on CNBC. And you can find these hits where I'm saying listen, all companies have crucible moments. Things are hard. And, that's kind of what makes the entrepreneur. So let's let these entrepreneurs keep growing. It's an amazing service. And they're like, but. And I'm like, I've seen this before. Trust me. But it is important to stay the heck out of the way when things are cooking. And then when things are hard, that's when you're show up on a Saturday or Sunday with the founder and say, let's go for a hike and let's have a real deep discussion about this. How are we going to solve this? What's the most challenging moment you had? Did you have any moments of running out of money, complete death? This thing's going to get unplugged?
I mean, we've had all of those. My expectation at this point is we have one major crisis every year. Maybe the one that's kind of most fun to tell a story about is this was just 2 years ago, almost exactly now, where we've sort of famously been dating with Rolls-Royce for them to build an engine for our airplane. And we had, long story short, we had decided that ultimately that was not the smart decision, that it didn't make sense for us to put all of our eggs in the basket of a 100-year-old British company that was sometimes, on some days, not even sure it even wanted to stay in the jet engine business. And so we said, just like SpaceX, we're going to build our own engines. And that was a project that we now started on. And we're spinning it up and incubating it, and we'd had a conversation with Rolls privately, where we thanked them for the partnership, and we said, look, we're going to do this a little bit differently because we're not getting there together, and let's find a face saving way to hug each other and say goodbye when we're ready to go say exactly what we're doing, and we just smiled and shook hands, and in the meantime, we were in the process of incubating what became our Symphony engine. And then American Airlines placed an order It was our largest order yet. And then there was this freak out because I think we had been this, this cute thing that maybe wasn't super credible. And United orders, maybe that's an anomaly. Maybe they did it for PR. But United ordered and American ordered. Like, you know, once you're lucky, twice there's something interesting there.
Yeah, and that's always where people...
Yeah.
But you're making the own engine now.
We are. The crazy thing was the idea that we would ever not do that, by the way. But so right. what happened is, so Rolls ran to the press and broke up with us. And so we went from being, you know, this darling thing that everyone was so excited about to like, they've got no engine. There is, you know, none of the engine companies are going to work with them. And this whole thing is just a glider. And like, so, you know, overnight, my ability to fundraise dropped to zero. Overnight, my ability to get new customers dropped to zero. Overnight, you know, it just like, it completely blew up on us. And, you know, and we were well into the process, but we didn't want to talk about it half baked with doing our own engine. And so there was this, I think it was from August or September through to December when we said, okay, we're ready to talk about what we're doing and how we're doing it, that there was this like big stink over the company. And, and then we had to go rebuild all the industry confidence because the way we went through that, you know, it created such a negative stink that, you know, the suppliers that wanted to work with us were like, you know, but you have no engine. And so, you know, it took us probably another 18 months to just kind of get all that momentum back.
And that's like basically a second startup inside your existing startup, like making the engine yourself. Sounds to me like it's technically more complex than making the plane. Am I correct?
I don't think so. Like it's close? It's yeah. Probably like, it's probably 50-50. But here's the thing that's surprising. There is no way this would work if we weren't doing it that way. And not just because the legacy supply chain would flake, which they probably would, but because so can you imagine SpaceX if Elon went to Aerojet Rocketdyne for engines?
Yeah.
Merlins?
It's like, how many do you want? All of them.
Right.
No,
it would take them 5 years to decide whether they wanted to do it, let alone to go invent and move at their speed. And so, and with a supersonic airplane, there's even stronger coupling because the way the engine and the airplane work together has to be really, really tightly matched. And so if you've got a company boundary between the airplane company and the engine company, like the rate of iteration is very low. And what ends up happening is the product isn't nearly as good. You know, so we were talking earlier about the breakthrough passenger experience that I can't share the detail yet. That is actually enabled by us doing our own engine.
That makes no sense, but okay.
It makes no sense. Let me explain why. To get the passenger experience we really wanted, we had to change the tube of the airplane a little bit.
Got it.
And it set us backwards on range. And we said, wow, okay, well, we want the airplane to be able to fly as far as we need it to fly, but we also want to have this thing that passengers are going to love.
Right.
Like, how do we do both? And that we found the missing efficiency by more closely matching the airplane and the engine. And there was a moment, this is actually pretty recent, that we just crossed the, like, yes, we can do all this technically. And I was in the, you know, I review the airplane and engine together a couple times a week, and we were in one of our Friday reviews. And the head of aero and the head of propulsion were like making out with each other in the meeting. and they're just like, look, we have both been at engine companies before. We've both been at airplane companies before. We've never been able to work together like this. And we just found 500 miles of range that we needed for the airplane to be able to do its mission. And we would never have found it any other way.
Well, this is, you know, one of the great skills of great entrepreneurs, but also of just contributors inside of entrepreneurial organizations is cross-discipline. And, you know, if you are somebody like Joe Jebbia, you know, and the co-founders, you know, Brian at Airbnb, they went to RISD. They got a lot of design skill. You start thinking about Airbnb. Every time you go to an Airbnb, you're like, this place is designed really beautifully. Well, that's because they looked at it and they would see the pictures of an Airbnb and like, this is not beautiful. And then they take better pictures. I'm like, oh, yeah, these pictures are better, but this is still not beautiful. And it's like, you know what would be nice? If there was like a coffee setup in the Airbnb, that was stunningly beautiful. Now, when I rent an Airbnb, and I love Airbnbs with my family, I prefer them to hotels, and I can afford to do either. You know, I noticed they all use very beautiful coffee stations. So something happened where, and then beautiful outdoor seating areas, and then like a foosball table or a ping pong table. Like there's something happening in that design panache and that patina, you know, that you see on the website that then translates to the experience. And he really has thought about that in a way that's, you know, not possible if you were just a business person trying to optimize a marketplace for the take rate or the supply side. You know, these are kind of intangibles. And there's a ton of stories about this as well with Tesla, where, you know, they were using Mercedes drivetrain. So on my Model S, which I just took, which was the first one, it has a Mercedes shifter and drivetrain. Whatever the drivetrain, I think it's the, you know, the steering wheel, all that kind of stuff. And so when I first like had to teach a nanny how to drive it to take the kids to school or whatever, pick them up, I was like, it's just like the Mercedes. We had a Mercedes next to it. It's the same exact thing, except you don't hear noise. But over time, he started, I remember when he started, when I started touring the Gigafactory with him, and he would be like, this is where we're going to make this. And this is where we're making that. And by the way, here's what we're making with the HVAC system. Now, you'd be like, why would you possibly waste time on the HVAC system, Elon? It's like, what do you think the number two after moving the car use of the battery is? It's not the display. Those LEDs don't use a lot of energy. It's the HVAC system. And so the fact, and that's when you see, I don't know if you've ever seen this guy who takes cars apart. Sandy Monroe, when he took apart the Y, it's an incredible video. He loses his mind when he sees the HVAC system of how innovative it is. And those are things that you would never think, like, okay, the HVAC's going to unlock 30 miles or whatever. It might have unlocked more than 30 miles. I don't know, 10%, 20%. So you could either increase the price of the car and the weight by putting more batteries in, or wait for physics and innovation to change batteries, or you fix the HVAC system. Pretty dope.
Right. Yeah, it is. It's so dope. And actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because it also, the technological arc of development at Tesla and at SpaceX and at Boom actually have some really interesting commonalities that somebody should write a book about this one day, because I think it actually will become the playbook for how you do a hardware startup. And if you, you know, if you look at SpaceX or Tesla today, they've earned the reputation as somebody who reinvents every piece of it. And because they have. But if you look back, that's actually not where it started. The original Tesla Roadster was a Lotus Elise body with a cell phone battery. And the original Falcon 1, it didn't land. It didn't even try to land. And it was small and it never carried a payload. And so they didn't actually invent anything new on the Roadster. They didn't actually invent anything new on the Falcon 1.
Well, the battery and the engine was probably a bit. Well, no, they used cell phone batteries. I take it back.
Cell phone batteries. Yeah, they had a motor, but it wasn't built out of like unobtainium. You know, it was the thing that was, you know, if you want to say there's one miracle, the one miracle is a startup could do it. You know,
that is the Falcon 1, well, think about it too. The Roadster, I remember taking a plane ride with Elon where he was essentially, I don't want to say losing his mind, but he was perplexed because they had just told him that the $150,000 Roadster I bought, number 16, was going to cost $190,000 to deliver. And he said, well, why didn't we charge $225,000 for it? He's trying to figure out like how these idiots were like, who had been running the company very shortly before he, you know, took over with founder authority and was like, wait a second. That doesn't make any sense. And man, they just were not doing that grinding of every single component. If you are making every component, well, think about the gains. If you wanted to make something 100% more effective or efficient, well, there's probably nothing that you can change that will make it 100% efficient. But there are certainly 25 things you could make 4% efficient in the next year or two.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. You know, but I think this goes back a little bit to what's surprising to people about Boom. I don't want to throw up the picture of the XB1 flying again.
Oh yeah, please.
But there is nothing that we invented on that airplane. Like, okay, it's got a carbon fiber composite fuselage. Guess what? Boeing did that on the 787. You know, we just made it the right shape. Those engine intakes, you know, ours are pretty efficient, but that's the same basic architecture for an engine intake that was done on Concorde. 1960s. There's an augmented reality vision system for landing, so we don't need that droop nose that Concorde needed. Well, and this was, but guess what? Gulfstream put something not all that different on the G650 for people to land on the clouds. Mm. And so, there is going to be an XB2, and there's going to be an Overture 2, and these things are going to have a lot of new technology in them.
Hey, with that augmented reality angle, you're looking up.
You're actually looking down. So if you look at the pilot there, so the reason Concorde had that droop nose was two things. One is for a supersonic airplane wants to be long and skinny, big pointy nose. And the other thing is with that triangular kind of delta wing, for takeoff and landing, for that to generate lift, the nose needs to be pretty high. So you come in to land like this. Uh-huh. And if it's the 1960s, the pilot can't see the runway, so they had to move.
Yeah, that's what I'm sort of getting at. Is like you just don't have the ability to see the runway, so yeah, game over.
Because the nose is in the way. Well, so today we've got this amazing thing called a camera, right?
You put a couple of those up front.
we put a couple of those up front, and they're about the wingspan of a bird apart from each other. So no single bird can take out both cameras. And then there's the pilot's a little toggle where they turn on the pilot screen basically flips over from a normal instrument to an augmented reality view, and you just look at the screen and you land the runway, land the airplane on the screen. My point was, like, we're cobbling these things together, but none of them are actually new. And I think that pragmatism is in the initial part of hardware is a really important lesson to learn if you're doing a hardware startup. Like these complex integrated hardware startups like Tesla, like SpaceX, like Boom, their first place that they're starting, they're actually integration of things that are proven, where all they're doing is bringing the integration together.
Yeah.
And then because they want to have a sexy brand and they actually do want to go invent new stuff, pretty quickly they get to the state they're in today where, you've got Starship and you've got the Octo Valve on the Model 3 and you've got the steer-by-wire on the Cybertruck and all this stuff. But then people forget where it started and that it has to start with that pragmatism.
Yeah. And you then earn the ability with your investors, with capital, with timelines to say, what, we're going to do this project. It's the unibody project. We're going to just stamp, like, that's like a moonshot kind of ish project, or we're going to land this thing, or we're going to make it much bigger. You start earning the right to do all that.
Yeah.
I have a stupid question. At the front of all of these supersonic planes is like a stick, an antenna, like a little tip on top of the tip. What is that for?
That's on a, let's bring the picture back up so people can see what we're talking about. So that's an artifact of it being a test airplane.
So it's
an air probe, and it's something called a pitot tube. And we've got a pitot tube on there.
Of course, pitot tubes do airspeed, right? And stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. They measure what's called ram air pressure, which is the force of the air coming at the airplane. And basically, if you compare the ram air pressure to the ambient pressure, the difference tells you what the speed is. And so if you look at the nose of XB1, we've got a pitot tube at the end of it. And then we've also got what are called alpha and beta vanes, which basically measure the nose angle relative to oncoming airflow. So is the nose up or down? Is it left or right? And the reason on a test airplane, it's way out in front of the airplane, is we don't yet have calibration data to put it near into the airplane. We put it right next to the airplane before we're 100% certain what that airflow pattern really is. We could be wrong. And so you put the sensors way out in front of the airplane where they're going to be in clean air, and therefore will be more accurate. But once you've got calibration data and you're in production, you get rid of the nose boom and it looks like every other.
But all planes have those, I think, right? Because there was that flight, there was an Air France flight from South America where these young pilots didn't understand the airspeed of the plane because I think the pitot tubes, or one of them had frozen or something. It was giving a wrong.
Yeah.
Do you remember that one?
That was Air France 447. It was from Rio to De Gaulle. What happened was, actually, this is a lesson in cockpit design.
Yes.
Because they had, they were up at altitude and the pitot tube, which the airspeed sensor, iced over. And so all of a sudden the Airbus, there were certain kind of automated protection features in the cockpit that would work only if it knew airspeed. And so the moment the airspeed data went away, it stopped having that protection. And then the two pilots, so they both had joysticks, And they're going to think of them as like your joystick on your, you know, on a home flight sim or on your Xbox or whatever. And so if you and I are flying an airplane together and you're on your stick and I'm on my stick, they can both move independently. So one of the pilots freaked out and hauled all the way back on the stick. And the other one...
to get elevation. He wants to get altitude.
Yeah, but...
we all know what happens when you do that.
That's right. So then the other pilot was doing the rational thing, which is a little bit of forward pressure. So, okay, they're not physically coupled. And what does the Airbus cockpit do when you're when I'm pulling all the way back on my stick and you're pushing?
I don't know. Split the difference?
Split the difference! It's the most insane thing.
That's the worst
thing.
Decision.
It's the worst decision. It flies the average. So the average of catastrophically back and a little bit forward is still catastrophically back. And so then so they just stalled the airplane all the way into the ocean.
The nose is going up, the lift goes away, and it just drops. And the pilot wakes up, the captain comes out who knows how to fly an airplane, because these guys don't obviously know what they're, or one of them didn't know what he was doing. You know, and he kills all the passengers. And he's like, no, dip the nose.
They had, and by the time they hit the ocean, the ice had all melted off and they had a perfectly fine airplane. There's a lesson in pilot training there, which the industry has really taken to heart. But there's also a lesson in cockpit design. And so when we revealed our cockpit about 6 weeks ago, like Airbus, we've got these side sticks, but they're force feedback side sticks. So that if you and I are, the Airbus thing had this alarm that would go off and it'd say dual input. But by the way, when you're in a crisis, there are 1,000 alarms going off and you miss
the
one
that says
dual
input. Like a Christmas tree. Yeah.
Right. So in an it's the connection between the pilot and until we can do autonomy, which I think is going to be a ways off for airplanes. Until we do economy, the tangible connection, the visceral connection between airplane and pilot really matters. And so if you and I are flying the airplane together, that we can feel each other on the stick. When you turn the autopilot on, it acts like a third pilot and it moves the stick. And so you can feel the autopilot forces. If you did take over from the autopilot, you're literally reaching your hand to where the autopilot's flying and you're taking over from that exact position. So there's this great, like, tangible, visceral sensory awareness of what's going on with the airplane.
So if they had
that on the Airbus, they never would have had that accident.
Oh, do we have a picture of your new cockpit design? Let's pull that up if we have it.
I think we have a video of it. I really love this. It's like going from a BlackBerry to an iPhone. Everything on this airplane you can control through software.
Yeah.
So it's glass avionics, with the exception
of that section in the middle where you have the thrust, right? That needs to be more visceral tactile. Is that right?
That's right. Well, we basically said everything needs to be software controlled. Some things also you want to have a physical control. And then we only added the minimum of physical control where it was important for that visceral feel. And, for normal flying, we also think about emergency situations. Like if there's a smoke in the cockpit and you can't see, there's certain things you need to be able to do just by feel.
Oh, wow. I never thought about that. Yeah. If you have smoke, you got to feel around to, change the flaps maybe, or
that's right.
Change the airspeed, right? Those are important.
So if you look at the details of the cockpit design, the really critical controls all have a physically different shape. So when you put your hand on it, you know what it is. Like the landing gear controller there it looks like a wheel. And you touch it, you don't have your hand on anything other than the landing gear controller.
Yeah.
And the flap controller
feels
different.
It literally looks like the landing gear.
It looks like the landing gear. And when you put your hand on it, it feels like the landing gear. This is really important in emergencies. Because what happens in an emergency is that the pilots get saturated. They get overwhelmed easily.
Yeah.
And then if you're using only the communication channel of the screen or an audio alert, you have a very narrow bandwidth ability to put more information to the pilot. So you have to make use of the touch. This can't be what I should have my hand on. It feels wrong.
Right. Let me ask you some stupid questions here since we're diving into the pilot experience. We'll have automation. Obviously, that's super important. But why are planes, we had MH370 disappear. I'm like really into this kind of stuff. Like once you go down the YouTube rabbit hole, I watched this guy called Blanco Lirio. Did you ever watch the Blanco Lirio channel?
I don't know that one.
Okay. Blanco Lirio YouTube channel. And I give this guy $5 a month on Patreon. Only because I think he ultimately will make people safer. So this is a channel here. And you can see he just takes every crash and he breaks it down. He takes all the data. He'll do like the Kobe Bryant helicopter crash the day it happens, 3 months later, 3 weeks later, 3 months later, 6 months later, a year later. It's incredible for education. And you have 370 disappears, right? And we have this, the greatest aviation mystery. I'm curious what you think happened. I have my own thoughts. I think it was intentional. But that's me. The thing that comes up is, why aren't these, given Starlink, given that we're all on the internet, why aren't these remote controllable from the ground? Obviously, hacking is a piece of that. Or why aren't people in the control towers or at Boom or at United not able to pull up the cockpit, a virtual cockpit, and watch the pilots in this Air France situation and say, hey, we're watching Air France. You guys have pitot tubes that are frozen. What are you doing? You're both pulling the stick the wrong way. And when is that coming?
It's coming on Overture.
Okay.
So I think I just made an announcement. We haven't talked about that before.
Okay.
But the Overture will have basically a remote tech support feature where pilots on the ground can get into a flight sim, and it will mirror exactly what somebody in the sky is seeing in real time. Now they can't control it, you know, and that's kind of a hardware lockout because you go down that rabbit hole. Now there's a security question.
But Al-Qaeda trying to hack into it and take a plane down.
That's right. But it's the airplane equivalent of you call tech support and you can screen share with tech support.
Perfect.
And the airplane equivalent of that is you press a button and there are two, you know, factory trained test pilots that can see and feel exactly what you're seeing and feeling and help you through it.
Huh.
And so that's, I think, if you peel the onion back and say, why has no one done that before? It's the lack of innovation.
So, back to our original discussion. Yeah.
Back to the original discussion. The last time Boeing did an all-new airplane was 2004. Now, satellite Wi-Fi hadn't really been invented yet.
Right.
Right.
And that's your answer. Yeah.
Right. Because so Overture, this blows my mind to say that in the year 2024, Overture is the first airline designed in a world where internet connectivity is a standard assumption. Like if you look at every other airplane out there, they've got the satellite humpback on the
to a satellite every minute, and like we are literally going to the bottom of the ocean trying to find a flight recorder to figure out what happened.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So
it's great to have flight recorders.
It's great to be flight recorder, but all that should be real time. And it should be built in. Like literally the SATCOM on today's airplanes is a bolt-on. And you can tell it's a bolt-on because it's got a hump.
What about pilots and having cameras in there to monitor the pilots in the cockpit? This is a controversial union issue, I understand. But you do have situations with pilots. Sadly, you know, it's one in, I don't know, a million or something. Some pilot shows up drunk. We had one who showed up on mushrooms and tried to hit some, you know, shut the engines down. I mean, there's some crazy stuff that's occurred. You have the Egyptian pilot who ran the plane into a mountain and committed suicide by commercial airline. These are very rare things that occur, but it would seem to me that on a human factors basis and studying pilots, having the video of the pilots in the box or being streamed when that plane went down, you know, from MH-70 or the 447, whatever it is, would be invaluable.
It sure would be. And also, and by the way, I think you're right that it was intentional. And the strongest evidence from that, from my perspective, is that there was a bunch of equipment that was turned off.
Mm.
And so they would have turned the cameras off, you know, the first thing. So
if they were allowed to, there could be a camera that's not allowed to be turned. So you think MH370 was intentional too?
I mean, no.
On a probability basis, it
seems to be the only thing that's consistent with the facts from my YouTube study of that.
If you think about it on who would want to do a cover up here, if you had a pilot who was suffering from depression or whatever mental illness and who did this intentionally, and you knew about it and you would cover it up, right? And it would be very confusing to the rest of the world. And I think that's kind of what happened here. The reason this is such a mystery and feels so weird to me I think, and to the rest of the world, is there's some amount of data it feels like the Malaysian government just didn't give to people. That's me saying it. I know you have to work with people, but
yeah,
like,
I mean,
I think there's some conspiracy going on here where they're like, let's not investigate it too much.
That I see a little bit differently. So I'm not aware of what data they could have shared that they didn't share. You know, this is not like, if you go back and look at the, you know, well, we're not conspiracy theory chat here. Now, if you look at the origin of COVID, there's a lot of data that the Wuhan or Chinese government had that wasn't public. And I'm not aware of any analog on that on MH370.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just thinking, like, they seem, you know, to not have done the most thorough job. I feel like they slow walked it in a way.
So they might have. So you have a favorite YouTube teardown of this. My favorite YouTube teardown of this is from a channel called Mentor Pilot, MENTOUR Pilot. And he does these awesome accident teardowns that go all the way down to the cockpit design. But he's got a really good one on MH370, including there's new data that did not exist when it first happened. This is a whole new way of tracking what happened to that airplane that they've been able to do in the 10 years that elapsed, that suggests a place where it might be that no one has looked.
Oh, wow. Is that the deepest location? Like, because they said in his simulator, he had flown a sim to like one of the deepest cliffs and locations. And so if he was intentionally trying to ditch in that area to make it unrecoverable, it wasn't the Mariana Trench, but it was like similar to like the depth. And then when they found the wings and stuff like that, they said, these wings are indicative of a controlled landing in water because they didn't shatter. So you're like, wait a second. It's so crazy.
I would love to see us go look at a place we haven't looked before and see if we can find that airplane, find the black boxes, and then we're going to know what happened.
Isn't it extraordinary how safe it all is?
It is. Actually, there's this weird paradox of safety. And in aviation, but literally the most dangerous part of flying is driving to the airport. Not by a little bit, by a lot. And it's great we've been able to accomplish that. It creates this sort of paradoxical situation where, you know, if something even like a little bit bad happens on an airplane, it's news. Versus in automotive, we have the equivalent of a 737 crashing every 48 hours and everybody dies. That's just the U.S. Auto fatalities in the U.S. And if you reported on it, you couldn't report on anything else. It was just take over all the news. And this is what kills me on the pushback people have about wanting driver automation to be perfect before we can roll it out. It's like, no, I would take a half automation because it would still be better than the carnage that we have on roadways today that nobody talks about.
30,000 deaths, about 100 a day. And it hasn't gotten better meaningfully, which is super interesting because you have Uber and Lyft and options for drinking and driving, yet you still have it. And it seems from the statistics that you still have a ton of drinking and driving, but we have this addition of distracted driving. And if you told me, I'm with you, you know, every single car has to have level 2 adaptive cruise control and stay in the lane. Oh, and automatic braking, which I guess would be 3. I don't know if automatic braking, emergency braking, and adaptive cruise control are considered the same thing. But they kind of are, right? Stop if you're going to hit something or, you know, adapt to the speed. It'd be very interesting if everybody was forced to have those on.
Yeah, I think there's something interesting there. And it's also how you manage safety over time. So if you look at aviation, you know, the early days weren't so safe. But, you know, every accident got a root cause review. And the industry, at least used to be really good at learning from these things. And the safety bars come up, and the expectations come up. And, you know, I think that like on-ramp is actually really valuable. And we, you know, every time I read something that's like, well, we shouldn't have self-driving cars until we can prove they're perfectly safe, I'm like, no, you're actually killing the on-ramp. You're killing the on-ramp to safety. And, you know, we have to allow things to come to market so long as they're better. And then we can make them perfect over time.
Yeah. Availability, I just looked it up while we were talking. Availability heuristic is the cognitive bias where people overestimate the likelihood of a bad thing happening based on some recent event. In psychology, you might call it catastrophizing, where you'd think about the worst thing. But our minds remember these things. And there are famous cases where in New York City, a child was abducted in Manhattan, and that everybody stopped letting their kids walk to school in Manhattan and Brooklyn when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, because rightfully, every parent was like, I don't want my kid kidnapped. And I was like, this doesn't happen that often. And the ritual of being able to walk yourself to school at 9, 10, 11, 12 years old is what turns you into an adult. And then the damage that caused to independence in kids in different generations would probably be greater than the occasional kidnapping and murder of a child, as horrible as that is, which speaks to like what you have to deal with, I don't know, suicidal pilots or Al-Qaeda taking over an airplane. These are edge cases.
I think it's exactly the same situation where we can trade a visible but small risk for an invisible but actually much larger risk. And so that's exactly what happened after 9/11, when your airport security went way up. And it's hard to measure what the real impact of that would be, but I suspect that airport security has killed more people than the terrorists did. And the way it did that is to, at the margins, nudge people from flying to driving. So there's some tipping point on how long does it take and how convenient is it? And at some point, putting a bit more friction at the airport pushes passengers to the margin out of the airplanes and into cars. You can see it on routes like New York, Boston. You used to have a lot more shuttle service than they do now. The air shuttles, the friction killed a bunch of air shuttles.
Yeah, and I used to take the Boston one all the time, and it would go from this marine terminal. I forgot the name of it, but it was at LaGuardia. It was the marine terminal at LaGuardia.
Yeah, exactly.
And you would go there. It was the greatest experience ever. You could walk up. It was every hour. You didn't book a flight. It was like taking the subway. Mm-hmm. You walked up. You would go, in my day, you went up to a counter. You gave the woman your credit card. You bought it. And then shortly thereafter, you had a kiosk. And there was like very little security. It was just, you go through and you get on and you could show up 5, 10, 15 minutes before the flight and still get on. Because what you would do is you would queue up at the gate. Imagine how revolutionary it would be if you could go from LA to San Francisco on Southwest, and it left on the hour, and you got there. If you got there an hour before, you definitely got a seat. If you got there 15 minutes before, maybe you got a seat. But if no big, you get a cup of coffee and you go on the next flight. You're first on the next flight.
Right. We need to bring that back. I think that's actually a harder problem than supersonic flight. Because the safety protocols can often be one-way doors, even when they're not really effective. I'll tell you a fun story. When I first got married, flew from San Francisco to Seattle, got married on Whidbey Island, then flew to through Heathrow and onward to Italy for my honeymoon. And we're like in somewhere in Venice, and my now ex-wife is like, honey, can you get the like blah 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 out of my purse? And I'm fishing through her purse. And I find a box cutter, which is the literal weapon used on 9/11. And it's gone through airport security and SFO and SeaTac and in Heathrow. And not found. And so but by the way, if there's a bottle of water, we're really good at finding that. Whatever has made airplanes safer since 9/11, and I think they actually are safer since 9/11, it's not the airport security.
No. I mean, and then you think about those doors, right? We reinforce every door so you can't kick in the door. That's a great innovation, right?
It is. I think two things have actually mattered. The door is one, and there's a second one. And it's
hold
social.
On, let me see if I guess it. See something, say something. People are super aware. It's obvious.
That's right. And in fact, that learning happened so quickly. It happened on the day of 9/11. The passengers learned that they should fight back.
Right.
And that's why the fourth flight didn't make it into the White House.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. That amazing. Learning happened in a few hours.
Those
two things have actually made us safer, but now we've got this airport security theater and like nobody knows how to get rid of it or simplify it.
Yeah. Amazing. Since we're wrapping up here, what's the path to autonomy in airplanes? Because we have many things. Like I bought one of these latest DJI drones. I was shocked you're allowed to fly these in Manhattan, and like my friend's flying his drone, he's teaching me how to do it, and you just hit a button, return, and this thing's 10 blocks away, whatever, it's out of visual sight, and he just presses return and it returns and lands in this little tiny park we were sitting in Manhattan.
Well, I think it's gonna start in counterintuitive places. It's definitely not gonna start with Overture. Like, this is not what we're doing here. But the I think the place where we'll start is with the small kind of vertical takeoff and landing airplanes that are getting developed now, where they've only got four. Yeah, like the Jobys and Archers, because they've only got 4 or 5 seats on them. And when one of those seats is taken by somebody, you have to pay.
Yeah.
Versus somebody who's paying to be there. Economically, it's a huge difference. And so, like, if you want air taxis to work economically, like, one, we're just not going to be able to find enough pilots for these things.
Yeah.
So it's not a jobs problem. It's like, well,
what is the point of flying a quadcopter like that? These things know exactly where they're going. They have very short missions. It's a very constrained environment. You're only going up to, I don't know what they fly, 5,000-10,000 feet. They're just zipping from Manhattan to JFK, or, you know, across the bay and from Oakland to San Francisco. I mean, these are going to be very short missions. And those things are already doing massive calculations in terms of the rotors. And if they do get knocked off balances, load balancing them, it's kind of baked into what they do, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think it'll start there. And, like, I think, you know, for commercial airplanes, it's going to be really, really, really a long time. And, you know, and the reason is because we've made that, like, one, when there are a couple hundred people on the airplane, they're 2 pilots, economically, it's not that significant. So there's just nobody with a strong financial incentive to go change this up. On one hand, on the other hand, like, the platform has gotten to a near perfect level of safety. And the question becomes, you know, is there a way to actually move forward on safety with autonomy? It's really hard to do that, given how nearly perfect the safety bar is today. And you look at things like, you know, Sully landed in the Hudson, you know, maybe I'm going to date myself quickly here, but, like, I think it's going to be a long time before we have an AI that's going to say, I'm going to land on the Hudson.
I'm with you on that. Yeah. Like, the edge cases is always the hardest part, which is why today, when an airplane is at whatever, 34 or 40,000 feet, it's on autopilot. When it lands in a storm, it's on autopilot, right? If it's in fog, it's on autopilot. In almost all cases. And, like, when do pilots actually fly a commercial airline? I wonder. But to your point, why wouldn't you have the two? If it's perfect, why would you take on that complexity? And it's already, what percentage of commercial flights are on autopilot, you think?
Every flight uses it at least once. And, you know, what percentage of the time is the autopilot active? I mean, it's on the entire cruise. And the longer the flight, the greater the percentage that is. So it's, you know, I don't know the numbers. It's got to be in the 90s.
Got to be in the 90s, right? Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. Right.
But then it turns out that there are those edge cases where you're going to be really glad there's a pilot there.
Yeah. Like when the those tubes freeze over. Pretty good to have a pilot. Yeah,
pretty good to have a pilot. Now there's a different way to solve that problem. I watch, like, every accident teardown video I can find, and then we try to learn what's the root cause and how do we fix it 3 different ways, which they can never happen in Overture. And so we were talking earlier about the active force feedback side sticks. That solves Air France 4047 one way. Another way to solve it is something called synthetic airspeed, which is even if the airspeed tube freezes over, you can use GPS and recent wind data to come up with a pretty good estimate. You can also use inertial navigation to come up with a pretty good estimate. There's a lot of ways you can kind of synthesize an airspeed. So if the tube freezes over, it's not all the automation still works. And the last thing is you make the automation not need a lot of sensors. And so, you know, on Overture, I don't think if you look at the Airbus cockpits, the flight controls have many different modes they can be in. There's normal mode, there's alternate mode 1, there's alternate mode 2, and it keeps going. There's a long list, and you spend almost all your time in normal mode. And if something happens and all of a sudden you're alternate mode, the pilots, you know, may not even remember what that really does and how it's different. And so a thing that we put a big focus into is not having a bunch of modes. Like, Overture has 2 modes, normal mode and reversionary mode. And reversionary mode depends on very, very little for it to work.
You know, it's really interesting. I was talking to my friend Sky Dayton, who was the original investor in Joby, and he was giving me the statistic. Like, we haven't had a commercial death in the United States, knock on wood. Got some wood over here. Since 2009. And I was just looking as we were talking at the last couple of fatalities, tragically. And when you look at them, like, it's unbelievable. Like, Collagen Air. I'm not getting on any airline called Collagen Air. Collagen Air? Sorry to college. Collagen Air? That was in Buffalo. It's one of these regional airlines.
Collagen Air is really good for your skin, though.
Collagen Air is great for your skin. Palm Air. flight, so, 5191 in 2006. Again, one of those regional things. I don't fly regional airlines as a rule. No American Eagle for me. Yeah, I won't fly them. You know why? I looked it up because I'm like you. I watch these things. If you eliminated the regional airline and recreational pilots, I mean, you've just accounted for the overwhelming majority of accidents are small planes with recreational pilots. I will not get in one of those. I have friends who have little Cirrus. They got this thing, that thing. Yep, no thanks. You got two gray hair pilots in the front, or preferably one salt hair, salt and pepper, one younger. I kind of like that combo. I never go in with one pilot, always two, never a regional airline, and never a small plane. You take those out, you've just eliminated, it's like eliminating getting in a car with a drunk driver or an old car with mechanical problems or a speeder or a distracted driver. I've been in a car where an Uber driver will start using their phone. I'll say, excuse me, I'm sorry, I have anxiety. When you're using your phone, can you please not use your phone? I'm still going to give you 5 stars. It's me. I'm just getting very anxious. Oh, no problem, sir. No problem.
It's a great way to handle it.
That's the way I handle it. I put it on. Always put it on me. That's the best way to handle it with service. You have a problem. Maybe you can help me. You know, it's like a Jedi thing. Listen, you're fascinating. Congratulations. We put you in the Twist 500. It's our top 500 private market companies. That doesn't mean anything right now because I just started it. But I'm indexing the top 500 private companies based on Alex Wilhelm and I, who's the co-host now, formerly of TechCrunch. And we're building this twist500.com, so everybody can go check that out. Welcome to the 500. Continued success. We're rooting for you. We cannot wait to get to, you know, for me, it's to get in LA and go to Japan. I don't know if you can make that one, but Hawaii and Japan is my dream.
It is. Well, I got to tell you the story about that, and then we'll let you out. But today, as you know, if you're leaving West Coast and you're going to Japan, let's say you got a Monday morning meeting in Tokyo. You got to leave midday Saturday. You get there midday Sunday. You go to a hotel room, try to sleep in the hotel room. Next morning, your alarm goes off. You're going to try not to sleep in the meeting. And then you come home, and the whole thing takes at least 3 calendar days. And you're messed up from the jet lag the rest of the week. And Supersonic doesn't just save you time, it saves you 2 whole calendar days. Instead of leaving Saturday night, you sleep at home. Sunday morning, the flight from West Coast to Tokyo is about 6.5 hours supersonic. What that means is an 8 a.m. departure, say from San Francisco, gets to Tokyo 6.5 hours later. It's now 8:30 a.m. Monday morning in Tokyo. And so, but to you, it's just Sunday afternoon. So we're awake. They're awake.
Right to the meeting. All the meetings and go
want.
To bed early.
Right to the meeting. Go to bed early. Come home if you want. You can do the whole thing in 24 hours. And so that's the magic of this. It's not just about hours. Mm. It's about days.
Amazing. Listen, we love what you're doing. Continued success. And we will see you all next time on This Week in Startups. Bye-bye.